Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Striking a balance between gun rights and gun control has been a political struggle in our country for decades now. Activists, advocates, and lobbyists work sometimes tirelessly to bring the gun issue to the forefront of political discourse, especially at election time. And it's not always a battle between right and left, necessarily. In a recent Democratic presidential debate, Hillary Clinton targeted Bernie Sanders for voting in 2005 to give civil immunity to gun makers, distributors, and sellers.
Let's reverse the immunity. Let's put the gun makers and sellers on notice that they're not going to get away with it.
Let's do more than reverse the immunity.
But was that a mistake?
And let me hear if there's any difference between the secretary and myself. I have voted time and again for the background check, and I want to see it improved and expanded.
Joining us now by phone is political scientist Robert Spitzer. He's the author of 5 books on gun policy, including The Politics of Gun Control, now in its 5th edition, and most recently, Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Ann.
You've written that each new massacre in the United States, instead of rallying grassroots support for gun control, only tends to erode the sense of shock that could lead to change. Why is that? What do we know about what's going on with that?
Well, two things occur. I mean, a rallying effect does occur after, you know, one of these terrible shootings where people do pay more attention to the issue, where they are outraged and where they, you know, will lend some support to the idea of stronger gun laws. But that phenomenon doesn't last very long for most people, because for most people, there are many other issues of greater importance to them, like the economy and foreign policy and things. But the other thing that happens over time is that, to some degree, people become immunized or inured to the violence when it happens so repetitively. And so a shooting that might have sparked tremendous outrage in years gone by may not provoke the same degree of outrage, just because there have been quite a number of these shootings over the years. And I would just add that this doesn't mean that America is becoming a shooting gallery. We are statistically a pretty safe nation in terms of crime. Crime rates have been declining for about the last 20-plus years. So, you know, law enforcement and stability in society is pretty good. Nevertheless, when these, especially mass shootings, happen, they attract so much attention that we do become concerned about our safety. But when this happens so repetitively, people begin to, I think, tune out that information to some degree.
Criminal violence in the 1930s brought about the National Firearms Act. What did that do?
Well, in 1934, Congress passed the National Firearms Act at the behest of the Roosevelt administration. It was the first significant national gun control law, and it was a response indeed to criminal violence. You know, the famous criminals of the late 1920s and 30s, like Bonnie and Clyde and many others that made so many headlines during that period of time, prompted a crackdown from law enforcement, but also the effort to restrict and to sharply restrict certain kinds of weapons, especially machine guns, notably the infamous Tommy gun, which was often used by gangsters, and sawed-off shotguns and some other weapons that there was a judgment made that these weapons should, you know, not be readily available to civilian hands. And while it is possible for a collector, for example, to own a fully automatic, you know, old-style Tommy gun, let's say, there's a very extensive process behind it. And it was a law that was actually quite effective in removing those guns from society and from criminal hands.
At that time, was there a lobby for gun rights? Was there somebody fighting against that legislation?
Well, the National Rifle Association did play an important role. If you go back and look at the congressional hearings from 1934 that were held, you know, on this legislation, representatives from the NRA did testify extensively, but they were not hard and fast against the legislation per se. There were elements of it that they favored and elements that they opposed, and you had, you know, a fairly sensible discussion in Congress and in the country about what this new federal law should look like and how far it should extend. And the result was this, you know, important law. So gun rights spokespeople and organizations did play a role, but they didn't assume the very tough and hardline stance that we see these organizations assume today.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about gun rights, gun laws, and politics. My guest right now, Robert Spitzer, he's a political scientist and the author of several books on gun rights in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Then there was the Gun Control Act of 1968, and that came on the heels of the assassinations of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Senator Robert Kennedy. What did that do?
Yes, that was the next really significant national gun law, and that established a variety of provisions regarding the interstate sales of guns, regarding other kinds of information that the government was now keeping and collecting. And it was, as you say, in response not only to prominent assassinations, but also to urban violence that seemed to be sweeping the cities, and there was a growing concern about gun violence in that connection. But it was a fairly significant gun regulatory measure from the time.
And again, the NRA was engaged in that?
NRA officials did testify before Congress, and it was a similar kind of response where they were expressing opposition to some elements of the legislation. There was a provision, for example, in the 1968 bill that would have called for handgun registration throughout the country. That eventually was removed, and that was part of the compromise to enact it. But NRA spokespeople and other gun rights people favored elements of the law but opposed other elements. And here again, it was politically controversial, but certainly not of the kind of white-hot controversy that we see today surrounding legislation about guns.
Right. And so when did it start to change? There was the Brady Act in 1983, and that established background checks for handgun purchases from licensed dealers. And then also there was the assault weapons ban the next year.
Yeah.
But after, go ahead.
Well, yeah. I mean, the real change took place, politically speaking, between those two periods of time.
Okay.
In the late 1970s, a more hard right and unyielding dissident group within the National Rifle Association took control of the organization from the more staid and less political leaders of that period of time in the late 70s. And from that moment on, they became more political, more politicized. The NRA devoted more resources to political activities and began to take a much harder line about any kind of gun control regulation. So by the time you get to the early 1990s, when there's much support in the country and from President Clinton as well to establish a system of national background check for handgun purchases and to put limits on certain types of assault weapons, it becomes much more controversial, but those measures do make their way through Congress and are implemented. But, the political stakes become significantly higher by the early 1990s.
When has the NRA always been funded, at least in part, of course, because there's a huge grassroots movement behind it, but has it always been funded by the gun makers necessarily?
Well, gun manufacturers and the NRA have long had a very close relationship. The NRA has long been the political front for the gun manufacturers, and they have relied heavily on the NRA for its political activities. And gun manufacturers and the NRA have one abiding interest in common, which is to see that in the modern era that there are as many guns pressed into as many hands as possible, both because that buttresses gun sales, which, of course, is what gun manufacturers do. That's the product they sell.
Mm-hmm.
And because the constituency, the base of support for the NRA is gun owners by and large. So they have that mutual interest. And in recent years, the NRA has really put the screws to the gun manufacturers. Politically speaking, for example, when some representatives of some gun companies have sought political accommodations with national leaders, they've been ostracized for doing so, and that has resulted in drops in gun sales for companies that were considered to be, not towing the line on gun rights matters. And so they've had this, close relationship, and of course there is a flow of money as well. And money is certainly important in politics. The NRA raises its own money, but they benefit as well from contributions from gun manufacturers, distributors, et cetera.
But politically speaking, how do you compare the grassroots of the pro-gun lobby versus the grassroots of the pro-gun control lobby?
Well, that's a very important point about why the NRA has been as influential as it has been. These days, it has around 4 million members, which is, you know, not inconsiderable, but we are a nation of over 300 million people, mm-hmm. and the views of the NRA don't represent the views of most Americans. But the NRA does have a very important political advantage, aside from being an interest group that is very skilled and experienced in political lobbying and political activities. It does have a very strong grassroots base all around the country, people who are gun owners and gun rights enthusiasts who can be readily mobilized by the NRA. And that's very important in American politics because there's an old axiom that says that a small but highly motivated minority can win the day politically over a large but fairly apathetic majority. And that's kind of the story, an important part of the story, about the influence of the NRA, because they can mobilize their people not just to vote based on the gun issue, but to contribute money, to go to meetings, to write letters, to make their voices heard very loudly to state and local decision makers. And in American politics, showing up is 80% of the game, and NRA members often show up.
Mm-hmm.
And the gun sort of control, gun regulatory forces typically, historically, have not been able to match that degree of enthusiasm. Although I will add that in just the last few years, some new pro-gun control organizations have engaged in some pretty significant fundraising and expenditure of monies, and have been working to build similar grassroots organizations around the country. And they've met with some success so far, and if they continue on that path in the years to come, they may be indeed a more effective counterbalance to the NRA.
More Americans favor than oppose tougher gun laws, but it's not a top issue for them. What do we know about why that is? Is it going to just continue to be the economy stupid for the foreseeable future?
Well, it is that in part. But the other component to that is the question of the extent to which any given issue affects you personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have opinions about a great many issues in American life, but many of those issues don't affect people personally, or at least they don't feel it affects them personally. Now, you know, if you're a gun owner and you own five guns and you hunt and you engage in target shooting or other things, if it, you know, it's a part of your life, maybe it's something you did with your father when you were a kid, so it has a certain emotional resonance for you. And on the other side of the equation, people have, you know, feelings, have generally Americans do support stronger gun laws, but for them, it's more, I would call it an abstraction, mm-hmm. in the sense that they don't have a personal visceral connection to gun control or the gun issue, unless, for example, they have been the victims of gun violence. And you do see the mobilization of people who have been affected by gun violence entering the gun issue because it did affect them and does affect them personally. But the percentage of people in that category is fairly small by comparison. So part of the equation is, does this issue really affect you, and do you have a gut feeling about it in terms of your daily life?
And then just going back in history a little bit to kind of cap that, after the Columbine High School shooting in 1999, the U.S. Senate did take action on new gun measures, but those were stalled in the House. What was the difference at that point? What had changed?
Well, that was a very pivotal moment because Columbine was one of those instances that really shocked the nation in a very unique and profound way, sort of like the Sandy Hook shooting did in the U.S. in December of 2012. And indeed, there was great pressure on Congress to take legislative action. The Senate, by a narrow margin, did enact some stricter gun laws, including having closing what was called the gun show loophole in terms mm-hmm. of the ability to obtain guns gun shows without background checks, and some other measures too that were fairly, you know, pretty limited, but that had widespread support. In the House of Representatives, the measure was debated fiercely, and essentially what happened was that the House passed a version of a larger bill that did not include the gun provisions, and the House and the Senate never met to iron out differences between the legislation, and it simply died. And while the public was very much interested in that, what happened was that the Columbine shooting occurred in April of 1999, and as the, you know, as the months wore on, as schools let out, as people went on summer vacation, as they turned their attention to other things, the intensity behind change began to fade, and that, of course, left the pro the gun rights side kind of having greater influence in the political field, and by not doing anything, nothing happened.
Right, they had the status quo.
Exactly. I mean, but, you know, politically speaking, it's easier to keep things from happening than it is to enact new legislation.
Right.
And that politically is an advantage.
We will continue our conversation on gun control, on gun issues and politics. My guest, Robert Spitzer, political scientist and author of 5 books on the issues. We'll continue in just a second. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how issues of gun rights and gun control influence the political process. Here in Ohio, Cincinnati Councilman and U.S. Senate candidate P.G. Sittenfeld recently raised the issue to contrast himself from both his Democrat and Republican opponents.
No matter how unreasonable the NRA becomes, it has always been able to count on the unwavering loyalty and the knee-jerk support of my two Senate opponents in this race, Ted Strickland and Rob Portman. When it comes to guns, Rob Portman and Ted Strickland are just different sides of the same coin.
Still with us is political scientist from the State University of New York at Cortland, Robert Spitzer. He's the author of 5 books on gun policy, including most recently, Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. And also joining us now by phone is a leader with the Buckeye Firearms Association in Ohio and a member of the NRA Board of Directors, Sean Maloney. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ann, for having me.
The issue of guns has been raised in Democratic presidential primary debates. And this week, Democratic primary candidate for the U.S. Senate, P.G. Sittenfeld, as we heard, set himself apart from his opponents on that score, calling for stricter laws. The NRA has had a lot of successes in recent years, especially in Ohio. Is there a tipping point? What does it signal to you when you see it popping up in politics in this way?
Well, you know, I found over time that it pops up more often than we think. If we go back to the 2013 recall elections in Colorado, gun rights certainly were under attack. And Mayor Bloomberg came in with a significant amount of money on that side. And they successfully recalled, the recall people recalled the leader of the Senate and another senator based on solely on their views on the Second Amendment and their gun rights. And then you can go back to a few weeks ago in Virginia. Virginia had their off-year elections where the entire Senate was up for election. And in two very key races, guns were basically the only issue. Mayor Bloomberg came in. I think he dumped $2.3 million in those two Senate races alone.
Mm-hmm.
And the pro-gun side kept those seats,
right,
became that issue. And it's not so much a polarizing issue, and I don't even see it that much as a partisan issue. When you get into your civil liberties and your civil rights, it brings all kinds out. And it's kind of it's a tipping point for many people because you look at their constitutional rights and everybody has a view and an opinion. And certainly in these races and more every race, it's whoever can get their people off the couch are the ones who vote. With voter turnout so low, issues like this are going to drive a lot of the electorate to the polls.
Robert Spitzer, I mean, is there a cyclical motion to all of this over time?
There is. Part of the cyclical nature of this issue relates to, you know, kind of what's happening, especially at the national level, where, you know, if you have some, you know, terrible moment of mass violence, it arouses the public's general attention, and there's at least the possibility that things might change. They don't always. And then you kind of revert back to a more normal political situation where most of the public isn't paying attention. I mean, the issue is always at play in some degree, just as Sean is suggesting. You know, you do have, for example, the Colorado race he mentioned, when the two state senators, the senators who had supported stronger gun laws were defeated, but the two gun rights senators who were elected in that year were then defeated in their next reelection. So, which happened because, in part at least, there was a higher voter turnout in their regular election. So another factor at play is who's coming out at the polls. Is it an election that's during a national year when you have a lot of people coming, or is it an off-year election when not so many people are participating?
You know, Time magazine wrote recently that not only has a spate of mass shootings reinvigorated grassroots liberal support for stricter gun laws, in other words, getting them out to the polls, right? But there are now wealthy benefactors of the movement. NRA's been a big spender for a long time. How does the influx of money on the other side of the issue affect politics? You mentioned in Virginia where they did not succeed, Sean Maloney, but overall, it is a little bit of a climate change.
You know, you're right. It is a little bit of a climate change. And that's why the Ohio races, especially for Senate, is interesting. In the past, for, you know, I think concealed carry has been on the books now in the state of Ohio for going on 11 years. And it really wasn't until Ted Strickland, the Democratic governor, that the people in Ohio could fully embrace their gun rights, so to speak. And so it's an interesting race when you have certainly Rob Portman has been a pro-civil libertarian, as Ted Strickland, mm-hmm. and Sittenfeld's coming in from the outside and running head-on. And if you look at the history of the Second Amendment issues and certain issues like that, for a long time, that was something that you just didn't address, because I think Bill Clinton said it best, that he likened Al Gore's defeat to the gun lobby, mm-hmm. And over again. But then you have Hillary Clinton running head on into the gun lobby, so to speak, and into what looks like the majority of Americans with a certain amount of constitutional play in the Second Amendment. I mean, she even was bold enough to say that she supported Australian-style gun confiscation in America. And so she certainly isn't running away from the issue.
Right.
And if you look at the headlines from Virginia, Newsweek articles, a lot of other articles, Republican defeat challenges in Virginia based on gun vote, Virginia mm-hmm. State debunks gun votes, test power on gun issues in Newsweek. So it's very interesting. I'd like to hear more about that. You know, what's Hillary going to do? And I guess why isn't she listening to her husband, number one, or somebody with a little bit more experience, and where she's going to go with this?
Well, it looks to me, Robert Spitzer, and tell me what you think, that when there's a contrast, gun issues become an issue.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to your earlier point about the cyclical nature of this issue. As Sean is suggesting, you know, Hillary is talking about the gun issue quite aggressively mm-hmm. in this campaign, partly because of recent events, the shooting in Charleston, the Umpqua Community College shooting in Oregon, and it's really brought the issue back to the fore. But it's interesting to compare with the last two presidential cycles in 2012 and 2008, when really the Republican and Democratic candidates avoided the gun issue as mm-hmm. much as they could, and it was little discussed, with the exception of a brief moment in the summer of 2012 after the movie shooting theater in Colorado. Mm-hmm. So the last two presidential cycles, candidates of both parties, including Obama, avoided the gun issue, but Hillary and some other candidates have been talking about it quite prominently so far, at least in this campaign cycle, and you can see that she was trying to use it against her opponent Bernie Sanders in some of their past debate encounters.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about gun policy and politics. My guests, both on phone, Robert Spitzer, political scientist and author of 5 books on the issue, Sean Maloney, he's a leader with the Buckeye Firearms Association here in Ohio and a member of the NRA Board of Directors. Questions or comments, what do you think about the gun rights issue coming up in this 2016 election cycle? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And listeners, I'd like to know if the gun issue is something, if it became an issue in 2016, is it something that would drive you to the polls, like something like marijuana legalization or gay marriage or something like that? Is that an issue that moves you? You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Ohio continues to pass laws making gun ownership more convenient. This week, a bill passed the House that it's not in law yet, but it passed the House that would permit Ohioans with concealed carry licenses to carry a gun inside a daycare center and in certain public areas of airports and police stations. That hasn't been the case in other states, dozens of which have passed some form of stricter gun laws since the Newtown Elementary School shooting, for instance. Is Ohio ahead of the curve or behind it? Or is every state sort of a different ecosystem, Sean Maloney?
There's a Ohio certainly is now somewhere in the middle. Every time Ohio passes less restricted gun laws, they become closer and closer to the mainstream. But Ohio's been one of the worst states for gun rights for many years. In fact, despite the fact that they have all these changes, which seem to be going the pro civil right, the pro firearm owners way. Ohio still is in the middle to the lower end of gun rights. So every law that they pass is just trying to get them closer to where we are for the rest of the states, because nothing that Ohio has done hasn't been done already in the majority of other states. And so that's what people need to understand. Although it seems like we're passing a ton of legislation dealing with gun rights, mostly it's just trying to catch up where everybody else, certainly all the states around us, already have these laws in place. And that's why I tell people not to get so excited, because this has been tried for years and done for years in other states. And, you know, with not all these adverse consequences, blood is running in the streets. You know, people often ask me, you mentioned daycare centers. I had to take my child into daycare centers a lot. And it's just 5 seconds to get out of your car, grab your kids, take them in, and hand them over. I think the reason why that was changed is one of the most dangerous times as a gun owner or someone who carries concealed, for example, even a police officer, to have their firearm is when they're holstering and reholstering their gun. And so now you're forcing somebody in the car before they took their kids in to remove their firearm from the safest place it could be in their holster, put it someplace, get out of the car, drop your kid off, come back in and do the same thing again. So this is just really safety measures. And if you look at most of the laws that have been passed, they're just catching up with the other states. And a lot of them have more to do with safety than anything else.
Robert Spitzer, are they just kind of those details?
Sorry, are they what?
Those kind of details, just keep catching up with other states.
Well, I would view it in a somewhat different way. What we've seen in the states in the last couple of years is that some states have moved to make their laws tougher. Other states have moved in the other direction, Ohio being one. It certainly is true that a number of other states have, you know, loosened their concealed carry requirements, made it easier to carry concealed firearms in various facilities. I think to, you know, include on the list daycare centers, airports, and police stations, you know, kind of calls into question whether the objective is really about good reasons for allowing people to do that, and is more a way of saying and flagging to constituencies that, look, we do support gun rights. But we've seen kind of opposite trends in among the states. Some states, like my state, New York State, enacting tougher laws, and I write about how those laws play out in my most recent book, and other states like Ohio that have been moving in the other direction.
Well, what's the difference between the states that are enacting tougher laws in a state like Ohio that Sean Maloney characterized as just sort of catching up?
Well, it goes to the nature of the politics of the individual states. And states, you know, some of the states are simply more liberal, or to describe it differently, you know, strongly supportive of gun safety measures. Other states want to make a statement in part. One of the reasons we've seen some more conservative states, some red states, enacting buttressed concealed carry laws, making it easier to carry guns in all kinds of places like churches and restaurants and bars and other places, where some of it's kind of a head-scratcher in terms of why you would stipulate that in legislation at all. But to some degree, it's a political statement to say, look, we don't believe that stronger gun laws are of any use or that they help, or we want to make a political statement that we just don't think the government should be doing these things or should be regulating guns, and so we're going to reply in a different way by, in fact, making these, you know, making it easier for people to carry firearms in, you know, these new listed places. So part of it is just a political signal saying we think gun laws are bad.
Sean Maloney, As far as some have said that a strong statement on gun control will motivate the base. We've talked about this a little bit. Get more Democrats, more liberal Democrats, I should say, because there's lots of moderate Democrats who, you know, who want stronger gun rights laws enacted. But we'll get more Democrats out to the polls. Do you see a tipping point on that score?
You know, I think probably if you look back to Virginia just a few weeks ago, certainly Dan Gecker was running against Studervant. And I think if you asked him, both of the Jeremy McPike and Dan Gecker, who were both lost in their reelection or their election bids based upon the gun control issue, really forced on them. Every town USA got involved, and they accepted the money. And I think if you ask them now, is gun control an issue you want to run on? Probably even before their defeats, they would say no. I think Robert, you know, he hit it on the head. It's a complicated issue, and it drives a lot of different people different ways. And so I think it's an issue that's going to be out there, and it does move a certain amount of the base. But now you just have to start considering, you know, what kind of base do you want to move? Certainly with the progressives, they're anti-gun. To them, I think it's more about power and their political power than anything else. But certainly you have to consider, okay, when you're looking at a civil rights base, who carries the bigger amount of vote? Is it going to be the pro-civil rights, pro-firearms, or is it going to be the anti, so to speak, that are going to get more people to the polls? And probably, and Robert, by far, is a better person to answer those questions. And Robert, I just want to say your books are amazing, and especially your latest is very insightful.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, Sean Maloney, I have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ian, for having me, and keep up the good work, everybody. I mean, all this goes in an informed electorate, and that's we can't ask for anything more than that.
That's Sean Maloney. He's a leader with the Buckeye Firearms Association in Ohio and a member of the NRA Board of Directors. Coming up, more conversation. We'll hear from some callers and get your points of view on the show. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In October, after the shooting at the Oregon Community College, CNN compiled numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and found that from 2001 to 2013, the most recent time available, well over 400,000 people died by firearms on U.S. soil. And the data covered everything from homicide to accidents and suicide. Still, although a majority of Americans favor stricter gun control, there lacks a grassroots push for it, or at least an adequate grassroots push for it. This hour, we'll talk about how issues of gun rights and gun control influence the political process. Still with us is political scientist Robert Spitzer. He's the author of five books on gun policy, including most recently, Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. Joining us now is the executive director of the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence, Jennifer Thorne. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me again, Ann.
So, we're seeing a push from Democrats, namely P.G. Sittenfeld, who's running in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate, because his Democratic opponent, Ted Strickland, is a longtime gun rights supporter. I think he gets an A-plus from the NRA. And then also Hillary Clinton, notably. She has, again, can create a contrast with her opponent in the primary and at the primary level. What do you make of this primary level energy against or opposing gun rights, or at least more restriction on gun laws, and how it might play off and play over into the general election?
So I think what we are seeing is that folks that are running for office are recognizing the strengthening of that grassroots movement for gun violence prevention, and therefore making it an issue that they are willing to campaign upon.
What are they seeing? Is it the money coming from Bloomberg, or is it some kind of electoral, you know, real grassroots strengthening?
I would say that what they are responding to is the fact that there are a number of individuals who are beginning to identify gun violence as one of their most important issues when they go to cast their votes.
So that priority list is changing.
Yes. I mean, I absolutely would agree with that. And certainly, you know, the additional folks that are in the gun violence prevention movement certainly doesn't, you know, hurt raising the profile of the issue.
Huh. Yeah. Robert Spitzer, is it money? Is it the money talking? Or are you seeing, even though it's not a top priority, gun control isn't a top priority for people who support it, like gun rights are for people who support that? Or is it a balancing?
Well, there is a question of money, to be sure, because former New York City Mayor Bloomberg has made a decision that the gun issue is one of his top priorities, mm-hmm. now that he's no longer mayor. Mm-hmm. And his new, it's a group that he formed in about 2006 initially that was Mayors Against Illegal Guns. But Bloomberg has been pouring a lot of money into his organization and into selected campaigns and races around the country. But so have other big spending individuals who are sympathetic to this point of view on the gun issue. And what's notable is that beginning in 2014, we saw for the first time in history that pro-gun control groups were able to match or even exceed the spending of the NRA, at least in selected races. And that's never happened before. Now, money isn't everything. Of course, mm-hmm. in politics, you want money. That's no dispute about that. And the other part of the equation for not only Bloomberg's group, but former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly have formed a group as well. Giffords and Kelly are both gun owners, but they, you know, are making the point that they support sensible gun safety regulations as well. They've been raising and spending money for political activities and have been quite prominent. And it does raise the possibility, and the dollar amounts being spent are certainly one indication, that there may be greater equity between the gun rights side and the gun control side in the years ahead, especially if Bloomberg's group stays with this, if they continue to do the money thing, if they continue to try and build grassroots support, and if similar groups do the same.
Right. It's that sustainability of the money to get through these rough patches. Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that, you know, we also need to look at the fact that there are a number of long-time gun violence prevention groups that have been working for decades often on this issue. And they are embedded in states and, you know, working, you know, year-round, even when there's not an election in those states, and building capacity in their organizations. And certainly, you know, it's fantastic that groups like mine are now at Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence are now, you know, also able to, you know, share in the victories with, the national groups that are coming onto the scene.
But we had Sean Maloney of Buckeye Firearms Association in Ohio just say that, you know, Ohio is behind the trend, and that it's just starting to catch up. And there's been a lot of success on their part, but they're just starting to catch up. I mean, what do you make of that?
So I would say that Ohio is behind the trend, but I think
you take the other tack.
yes, that's correct. You know, I think that there are a number of states that have passed stronger common sense gun regulations that Ohio has not. And we know states that do have stronger gun laws have lower incidence of gun violence. It's that simple. And, you know, I think that oftentimes it is a political exercise for gun lobby and gun group back legislators, particularly in Ohio, you know, when they're wanting to loosen restrictions, such as with this Guns Everywhere bill that just passed in the House and is now heading over to the Senate, you know, those policies would do nothing to make Ohioans safer. But what they do is kind of it flexes the muscles of the folks that are currently in power in our gerrymandered legislature, and also endears them more to the gun lobby. And, you know, there will be more guns sold, and that makes more money for gun manufacturers.
Robert Spitzer, as far as gun laws go and gun restrictions go, is there an argument to be made that stricter gun laws lead to less gun violence, whether it's accidental, suicidal, or homicidal?
That's a good question. A couple points. One is that there have been a number of studies that have made the point that there is pretty much a straight line correlation between states that have strict gun laws and have lowest gun crime versus states on the other end of the spectrum that have very few gun regulations that also tend to have the highest rates of gun violence. Now, that trend is particularly significant, not so much with gun homicides as it is with gun suicides, because one of the little recognized facts about gun violence in America, you alluded to it earlier on, is not only, of course, we have gun homicides, gun murders every year, but twice as many people are killed by guns in suicide efforts every year. And indeed, we know that ready gun availability is highly correlated with successful suicide efforts for the reason that there is no implement or thing that you can think of offhand that's more effective, frankly, in completing a suicidal act than a firearm. And that issue of access and of storage and safety questions is one of the most important questions that continues, I would say, to not get the attention that it's due.
Sean in Columbus, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Hey, I was wondering why the interpretation of the Second Amendment in these arguments always seems to be taken out of context, in that the very first sentence of the Second Amendment that says, in the interest of a well-regulated militia, comma, they always take all the stuff after the comma, and I'm not anti-gun. I'm just saying that this debate seems to be not really about a constitutional right, in that the constitutional right was set up for the interest of a well-regulated militia, which is obviously not where we are now.
Robert, well, I want to ask Robert Spitzer that. That's an interesting question, because it wasn't always framed, at least just from a casual observer like myself over the years, it wasn't always framed in terms of the Second Amendment, was it, the argument for gun rights?
Well, Sean raises a very important question. In most of our history, the Second Amendment was interpreted to refer to, indeed, well-organized and regulated militias, because the first half of the amendment says that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And courts and legislatures and most around the country interpreted that, I mean, to the extent this occurred, interpreted that to mean, and indeed the people who wrote the Second Amendment in the first Congress of 1789 framed it entirely in military terms. It was all about America's national defense using militias, which was our major source of national defense, and it was also in the context of the fact that militia-eligible men were supposed to own and get their own firearms.
They were required to
service. That's exactly right, by federal law and by laws from all of the states. It's only in 2008, in the very controversial and important Supreme Court case of the Heller case, where the majority of the Supreme Court effectively strikes out the first half of the sentence of that composes the Second Amendment, the militia part, and decides that as of 2008, the amendment provides a personal right for an average citizen, a civilian, to own a handgun for personal self-protection in the home. And that was the conclusion of the court. Adding on to the fact, however, that in that case they were very clear to also say that basically most existing gun laws were fine. And that goes to one other point, which I make in my most recent book, which is that in most of our history, gun rights and gun laws were perfectly compatible. It's only been in about the last 30 years where we view these two things as antagonistic.
Okay, Sean in Columbus, number one, thank you so much for your call. Sean in Columbus, number two, you're on the air. Hi, Sean.
Yeah, I was confused at first.
Yeah, I know.
Thanks for taking, three Sean on the show today.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
So, thanks for taking my call. My question is really for your guest. My question, comment, is really this. You know, when I think about, you know, the example of 9/11, after 9/11 happened, we had a strategy, right? We increased defense spending, we increased surveillance, you know, we had somewhat of a national strategy. Well, you know, you just alluded to it earlier, and 400,000 Americans have died, so was 2001 since, you know, from gun violence, and we don't really have a strategy to deal with that, you know, and that's on both sides of the aisle, and that's kind of concerning to me. And my question comment is really, you know, you hear mostly conservatives say, well, this is a mental health issue. People who should not have guns, and that causes problems for everybody. Well, then my question to them is back is, well, where is the bill to deal with that? You know, I don't know if you saw John Oliver had a great bit on his show a few weeks ago. We talked about mental health, mm-hmm. and I didn't know about this, but there's a program in Las Vegas where they literally send schizophrenic, you know, people with severe mental health illnesses to Los Angeles on a one-way bus ticket, and they just it's called bus therapy or patient swapping or something like that, and they just let them go, and that's so concerning to me. So I wonder what your guests have any thoughts or insights on. If this is a mental health issue, then where is the bill? Where's your ideas to deal with the mental health issue?
Well, and further, I think that your first point about a strategy and a larger strategy, that's kind of an interesting way to frame it. I mean, it seems sort of simplistic, but I get what you're talking about. And Jennifer Thorne, what about that? And John, thank you so much for your call. What do you think about the idea? Where is that? Is there something missing there?
I think that there is a strategy. And we're having difficulty a lot of times having our elected officials, and quite frankly, the ones that you know hold the power at this point, in a lot of ways, to make this a priority. There have been a number of efforts recently. Federally and in Ohio, to strengthen gun violence prevention regulations, and you know, quite frankly, it's just difficult when you have individuals on the other side of the issue that are so entrenched with the gun lobby. But I would like to just speak a little bit to his point about mental illness and the connection with gun violence. And what I will say is that individuals who suffer from mental illness are actually much more likely to be victims of violence rather than perpetrators. And, you know, certainly performing our mental health system is a very worthy goal. But even if we solve that problem completely, there would still be a lot of gun violence left. And things like rage, so anger issues or drug or alcohol abuse are actually much greater indicators of someone becoming violent with a gun than mental illness. And you know, we're also looking at, you know, talking about suicide by firearm being the number one, you know, firearm related fatality. And that's a lot of times where you do see that connection with mental illness.
Robert Spitzer, we just have about a minute left, and I wonder if you could address Second Sean's point about that strategy. That he sounds frustrated that he isn't opposed completely to regulation he isn't opposed to gun rights per se, but he thinks with something like 9/11, we came up with a national strategy. What have we done with this?
Yeah, he makes a very good point, and it's part of the problem with the gun issue, which is there's so much heat that there's not a lot of light by comparison. Certainly, the mental health issue is an important one, as Jennifer's suggesting. In fact, 95% of people with mental health problems are not violent. I mean, violence is not a problem for them. They have other problems, to be sure. Mm-hmm. There is, and most gun violence is tied more to the issues she suggests of anger, of alcohol, drug abuse, things like that. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the mass shootings in America, which is a very small number of murders that occur nationwide annually, mm-hmm. nevertheless, many of the mass shooters have been people with profound mental health problems, and that does give rise to that debate. But where is the concrete policy solution from the gun rights community on the mental health issue? I think we haven't seen it, and mm-hmm. we should be seeing that. And there are certainly steps that could be taken on that issue and on gun safety issues that could certainly improve the picture without depriving anybody of their rights.
Robert Spitzer, thanks as always for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Robert Spitzer, political scientist and author of 5 books. We'll have links to those on our website at WOSU.org. Jennifer Thorne, executive director of the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of our listeners. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.